From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director and writer John Sayles. His movies include The Return of the Secaucus 7, The Brother from Another Planet, Baby It's You, and his current release, Mate One. Also today, I talk with the father of modern jazz trombone, J.J. Johnson. After nearly 20 years as a Hollywood composer and arranger, Johnson is returning to jazz performance. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Dances and Ballads, the new album from the World Saxophone Quartet. And television critic David Bianculli previews Jack Parr is Alive and Well, NBC's look back at The Tonight Show's former host. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is film director, writer, and actor John Sayles. He's one of the few young filmmakers who has managed to make small, personal films that have turned profits at the box office. His early movies, like Return of the Secaucus 7, about a reunion of old college friends, and Liana, about a woman involved in her first lesbian relationship, were both made very cheaply. Consequently, the focus was on dialogue and ensemble acting, not on action scenes, exotic locations, or period authenticity, which would have broken the budget. Those films, as well as his movies Baby It's You and The Brother from Another Planet, established his track record. Now he's able to shoot more technically ambitious movies. His latest film, Mate One, is based on the bloody battle to unionize the coal miners in Mate One, West Virginia. It's set in 1920 and was shot on location in West Virginia. Sayles wrote the screenplay 8 years ago. He's now completing a new movie called Eight Men Out, based on the Black Sox scandal of 1919, when members of the Chicago White Sox conspired with East Coast gamblers to throw the World Series. That's from a screenplay he wrote 11 years ago. It stars Charlie Sheen, D.B. Sweeney, and John Cusack. I spoke with John Sayles earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him why he's now going back to screenplays he wrote early in his career.
I think it's more catching up than going back. They were both screenplays that I wrote when I was just starting in the movie business about 10 years ago, in the case of Eight Men Out, about 8 years ago, in the case of Mate One. And they were things that I wrote almost just for myself, saying, this is a movie I'd like to make someday. And I had no track record as a director when I wrote Eight Men Out, and I hadn't even done Secaucus 7 yet, although I'd written it when I wrote Mate One. So that it was unlikely anybody was going to knock on my door and say, I hear you're working on a very expensive period piece. We'd like to give you the money to direct it. So it's taken a while, and some of what I've done and the rest of the work that I've done has been to build up to the point where we could raise the money to make these two.
You've probably learned a lot since you wrote those screenplays 8 and 10 years ago. Are there scenes that you had to rewrite now that you know what it takes to actually shoot a scene? Scenes that seemed easy on paper, but now that you've actually been directing for a number of years, you realize that they were too difficult, too expensive, or maybe impossible?
Yeah, I'd say often there are scenes that have to do with large, you know, either large crowds or large physical objects. In Mate One, I had some scenes at the beginning of the movie that used a coal tipple and a coal camp. And we just didn't find enough of that stuff standing in West Virginia, and we didn't have the money to build it. So the camera's a lot closer to action at the beginning of Mate One than originally it was in the screenplay. With Eight Men Out, which is the story of the Black Sox scandal of 1919, radio hadn't really evolved past the crystal set stage in those days. And so the way that people kept tabs on the World Series, because there was an incredible popular interest in it, was they'd go to their local newspaper, and outside the local newspaper there would be a huge mock-up of a baseball diamond, and somebody would be moving figures from base to base as they got the news of what was happening in the park through ticker tape. And in Times Square, as a matter of fact, up where there's a kind of moving billboard now, they had men up on scaffolds with, you know, 15-foot-long poles moving big figures around, and it was as crowded as New Year's Eve. And that shot, needless to say, I couldn't afford to shoot.
So what do? You rewrite it?
Yeah, you rewrite it. You find another way to tell that same part of the story. You know, I can pretty much break my screenplays down and say, this scene tells you this, this scene is for this moment, this scene is supposed to touch this nerve, this emotion. And if you look at the screenplay and say, I still need to touch that nerve, I still need to tell this story, you find another way to do it.
Mate One, the story of Mate One and of the miners' strike there is obviously a very important story to you. It's a screenplay you wrote about 8 years ago, and mm-hmm. it's something you've been interested in producing all of those years. Now, you grew up in Schenectady, far away from right. any mining towns. How do you identify with the story?
Well, I think the basic parts of the story that interested me, besides just the historical fact that it's an incredible story and very few people know the history, is that it's about union with a small U as well as a capital U. How do people get together? How do they form alliances? How do they overcome the things, racism, ethnic separation, whatever, that keep them apart and keep them from cooperating with each other for something that they both want? And that happens everywhere. The story of Mate One just seems that it's the epitome of a lot of things. And it was set at a real turning point in American history. The ideals that America was founded on have been tested many times, and 1920 was one of the times when they were tested all over the country.
Both Mate One and your forthcoming film, Eight Men Out, about the Chicago team throwing the 1919 World Series, they're both period films.
Mm-hmm.
And period films are a lot more expensive to shoot, aren't they, than films set in the present?
Yeah, you basically have to, every time you turn the camera on, make sure that everything in front of it looks like it could be from that period. You have to make the people look like they're from that period, whether it's, you know, doing something with their hair or changing their clothes or whatever. So you have a conversation almost every morning during pre-production of, well, how are you going to shoot this and are we going to see their feet? Because, you know, the costume person has to know whether to order up 400 pairs of shoes or that are period shoes or not.
Now, you shot Mate One in the town of Thurman, West Virginia, and mm-hmm. I understand you did that because Mate One no longer looked like a coal mining town at the turn
yeah,
of the century.
Yeah, it still, you know, looks like a small West Virginia town, but, you know, it has modern buildings and, you know, street lights and all these kind of things that really we would have had to take down, whereas Thurman really didn't have any of that stuff up. So we, you know, we were able to just kind of cover a few things up and refurbish a few things, and there we were.
I know there in the past few years, some places have resisted filmmakers coming into their neighborhood and turning the town upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run into anything like that with Mate One?
Not really too much. Thurman's a very small town, so you really could talk personally to almost all of the 60 or 70 inhabitants.
That's a really small population.
That's a very small population, and a lot of them don't even live right down in town. You know, there were a few people who were upset when we put a lot of dirt over what little sidewalk they had there, and then it rained. But that only lasted like a day. And, you know, we're very careful to, you know, provide other ways around things and clean things up as soon as we're done with them and all that kind of thing. But really, I think it was kind of, we were the entertainment in town for a while. You know, the train still comes through Thurman, but not much else stops there. There's whitewater rafting across the, you know, the river. But I think it was fun for people to just kind of come on down and see what we were building or what we were shooting, and we really made an attempt to make sure that there was always a place for people to sit and watch.
Film director John Sayles is my guest, and right now we're talking about his current movie, Mate One. When you're shooting a film that's set in the past, for instance, in Mate One, you have a lot of browns and dark colors. The lighting, I think, is different than it might have been if it was set in the present. How did mm-hmm. you try to evoke the past through the lighting and through the kinds of through the palette that you used for the film?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a very kind of subjective thing. For one thing, the pictures that we have from that period are all in black and white. So in the kind of imaginative memories of people who weren't there, that history is in black and white. And so that kind of bright, clean, Disney-like color seems more of a movie thing than a realistic thing. And since we were going for something much more naturalistic, we decided to desaturate the color a little bit. Another decision that we made is very often the past is seen, you know, through a glass dimly. It's kind of filtered, and it's a little bit gauzy, or they put some diffusion on the lens or pre-fog the film. If you think of McCabe and Mrs. Miller or The Godfather, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that can give you a very kind of rich look that has the edge off of it. It doesn't make it look like the 6 o'clock news. And so it feels like it may have happened in the past before the 6 o'clock news existed. Sometimes, however, that gauziness, and I think particularly in the case of you know, when it's overdone, can make things less real and way less. It can get a bit like a you know, postcard or something like that. And so we decided to, rather than having the diffusion be mechanically put on the lens or done to the film, that we would desaturate things by controlling what colors went on the screen, rather than putting a lot of diffusion filters in front of the lens. So things are fairly sharp, and that helps them keep their weight. And, you know, in a story about coal mining, we wanted things to have weight. We wanted things to, you know, seem to be heavy and solid.
Was there someone whose job it was to smear coal dust on all the coal miners?
Yeah, I mean, there's, things kind of go down the pecking order a little bit. Haskell Wexler and Nora Chavusian. Haskell was the cinematographer and Nora was the production designer, and they kind of decided what would look like what. Then Cindy Flint was the costume designer, and then the people who worked under her would go with these Hudson sprayers, which are like giant flick guns, and load up a mixture of coal and water and spray everybody down when they were coming into or out of the mine. You know, and if they were coming into the mine, they just spray their clothes, because generally you used your clothes for about a week before you got to wash them. And if they were coming out, they'd spray their whole bodies, and then we had a assistant hair person who had been a coal miner, and he basically taught all the extras who hadn't, you know, some of them had been coal miners and some of them hadn't, basically how you get coal schmutz on your face, which is that you scratch your nose and you scratch your ear and everything. So he just put some coal stuff on their hands and let them go to it.
For the movie you're working on now, 8 Men Out, you had to find a ballpark that you could use and dress it to look like it was a ballpark in 1919. Mm-hmm. What were the changes you had to make? Which ballpark did you use, first of all? And what kind of changes did you have to make to it?
Well, we ended up using Busch Stadium in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Is that an old stadium?
Yeah, it's a fairly old stadium. I'd say it was built in the 30s. So it doesn't have a huge electronic scoreboard or AstroTurf or any of those things. What we did have to do was put wood-paneled contact paper on all the seats, which were plastic. We had to take down most of the big lighting fixtures. We had to avoid shooting in certain directions because there was, you know, Indianapolis doesn't have an enormous skyline, but it does have some skyline, and it doesn't look like 1919 anymore. And basically, to make it look like two different ballparks, we put up different billboards in the outfield. One of the advantages of that period was that there were fairly high outfield walls, and that they had a lot of advertising on them, so you can give the outfields a very different look. We changed the color of the dirt from one park to the other. We changed the color of the, you know, the walls behind the home plate. You know, we changed the pillars. We put false pillars up. Comiskey Park in Chicago has these beautiful arches, and we built fake arches to stick in the, you know, in the back of the stadium. So it's a pretty massive job. I mean, it's really one of the biggest things that I've ever been involved in, and certainly Nora Chavusian and Dan Bishop, who basically designed and made sure the whole thing didn't blow down. It's the biggest thing they've been involved in.
This would have to be a cast of thousands movie just to fill the ballpark.
Yeah, getting the thousands was very difficult. But what you do, and I think they've done on almost all baseball movies, is that you have to be very, very specific about where are we going to point, how long or wide is the lens going to be, And are we going to move the camera? Because you're never going to be able to shoot for 3 weeks and have 12 to 15,000 people every day. Some days you're lucky to get 400 or 200. And so we had to, before we started shooting, know, number one, how did the sun move around the ballpark? Because you don't want somebody pitching a ball in bright sunlight, and then by the time you get to the shot of the batter hitting it, have everything being shade. So you have to know where the sun is moving, and then you have to move whatever number of fans you have that day around the ballpark to keep them, you know, behind the players. And so you start them over in the right field side, in the case of this ballpark, because of where the sun came down. And by noon, they're kind of behind the plate. And in the early afternoon, they're over on the left field side. And you just keep shooting around the park that way.
Well, I guess one nice thing about directing thousands of extras in a baseball park is everybody knows how you're supposed to behave in a baseball park.
Yeah, pretty much they are. You know, they know to follow the ball with their eyes, and you don't have to worry about, okay, are they looking in the camera? Because, you know, unless you get really close up, you know, they're not totally in focus. And then when you get really close up, you just kind of have somebody go out in the field and throw the ball around and have them follow the play with their eyes.
Were the actors really playing, by the way? Did you have a lot of extras on the field?
There's no stunt stuff on screen. You know, there's no stunt doubles or anything like that. So the actors really did play. And, you know, it's you find out fairly early who can do what. And we were very lucky because some of the guys who have major parts, Charlie Sheen, D.B. Sweeney, John Cusack, David Strathairn, are really good ball players. And that's always nice. And what I told them at the beginning is not to get too uptight when they made an error or something like that, because unlike the major leagues, they get to do a second take.
Right.
You know, and they only have to do it, you know, and have it look like a major league throw or hit or catch once, whereas, you know, if you're a major leaguer, you have to do it, you know, 9 times out of 10.
Well, this is an advantage we'd all like to have in real life.
Oh, definitely. Instant replay.
My guest is film director and actor John Sayles, and his movies include Return of the Secaucus 7, Liana, Baby It's You, Brother from Another Planet, Mate One, his current movie, and Eight Men Out, his forthcoming movie, which is about the Chicago Black Sox scandal of 1919. He's also the author of a new book called Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. We'll talk more about movies after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director John Sayles is my guest. When you're about to begin a movie, do you have every shot already mapped out on paper? Do you know exactly what you're doing each step of the way?
Not exactly what you're doing. You have to have an idea because you have to tell other people who are working with you what to expect. So in the case of a production designer or art director, if you're going to be shooting in a certain hollow and all the buildings have to look like they're 1920, you have to know what directions you're shooting in. Are you shooting 360? Are you shooting 180? Are you shooting only up against this one specific wall so they don't go art directing everything in sight to make it look like 1920 when, in fact, you can save all their time and money by saying, we're only going to shoot against this wall. We're going to be using a, you know, 50 millimeter lens and give us about 20 feet on each side leeway in case we want to move the camera slightly. Sometimes when it's very expensive, yes, you have to go in and plan everything. Other times when, let's say you're up in the hills, you don't, you know, because a tree is a tree, and pretty much the trees look the same in 1920 as they looked, you know, in 1986 when we shot the movie. In fact, some of them are the same trees. Whenever you're shooting outside, you have to pick certain things to shoot first in the day and certain things to shoot at noon and certain things to shoot later in the day just because of the way the sun moves. In Eight Men Out, the nice thing is that I knew that even before we found the set, I knew certain things were true, which is that it's always 90 feet from home plate to first base. And, you know, no matter where we found the ballpark, the dimensions of the field were going to be similar. so I could do a certain amount of blocking even before we found the actual location.
Throughout your career, you've made movies that have been pretty low budget. Even your expensive movies, mm-hmm. like Matewan, are low budget by comparison to the films everybody else is making. You
right.
really bring things in at a very modest price. I think for a lot of film directors, one of the tricks of doing that is to not work with a union crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious with the movie Matewan, which is about unions, if you used a union crew for that.
Yeah, actually, we used several unions.
Mm-hmm.
It just turned out that we worked with both IA and NABIT, which are the two big craft unions. And it was a Screen Actors Guild union, and it was a Writers Guild union, and I'm not in the Directors Guild, so it wasn't a Directors Guild picture. But yeah, we made a special effort to have Matewan be a union picture, and it cost us some extra money. But, you know, there's always trade-offs. There's people who are in those guilds and unions who are very good, who you like to work with. And, you know, I've made non-union pictures as well. Usually what's happened in the past before Matewan is that they've actually been mixed, which is that some of the members of the crew are in a union and some aren't. And you basically pay them the same amount, except the people who aren't in the union don't get the same benefits.
When you make a movie that's non-union, does it make you feel like a hypocrite, or do you feel that there are really strong, important, acceptable reasons for doing it that outweigh that? Or do you think maybe that the role of unions in the movie industry is different than it was in the mining industry?
Well, the role of, you know, most unions in the movie industry are not unions, they're guilds, and,
mm-hmm.
and that's a strong confusion, you know, and it's very difficult to operate as a union when you're really a guild. The problem I'm afraid with most Hollywood unions is that they were set up when there were big studios. You came in every day, you worked 50 weeks a year, you had 2 weeks vacation, there was always something shooting on the lot.
And everyone was on salary.
And there weren't really independent people running around making one movie every 3 years on whatever money they could scratch together. So it's a very, very different situation. You know, the unions came about at a time when it was a very stable industry, when in fact it was a monopoly, when the studios owned their own theaters and distributed to their own theaters and knew that they had an outlet. And so there was a lot less risk involved. Now that it's a very risky thing, I'm always willing to say to a bunch of crew people or a union, let's do this as a collective. You know, I'm putting my own money into this thing. I'll put my money and my time in for free if you put your time in for free. And then we'll figure out some kind of hourly, you know, who spent what time on it. And if there's any profit at the end of it, we'll all split it equally, which goes beyond a union. But nobody's interested in doing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. None of the unions are interested in doing that because it involves risk.
Yeah, and I guess they don't have the kind of personal investment in the movie that you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's your vision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in your work as an actor. You've acted in several of your movies, and I think you're a really good actor. I've seen
you
in I forget the name of the movie, in someone else's movie, too, I saw you.
I was in Hard Choices.
Hard Choices, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, you always... in your own movies, you always play a character on the margins of the action or a kind of bad guy type.
Uh-huh.
In Leanna, you are this real macho, kind of unlikable guy, but it was very funny the way you played
uh-huh.
it. You were a kind of enforcer from outer space and the brother from another planet.
Mm-hmm.
In Matewan, you're a hellfire and brimstone preacher. How come you give yourself those kinds of roles?
Well, I think the marginal part is just because it's hard to direct and act at the same time,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're doing some kind of character thing. I think the people who are most successful at directing and acting over a period of time are people who basically have a persona, like Buster Keaton or Woody Allen or Clint Eastwood, and very often that's who they're playing in the movie, so that the... You know, they've played that character before. They don't have to do all the work to figure out who the guy is. And also, I imagine they're just better at it than I am. I have a hard time directing and acting at the same time. As far as the bad guy thing, that's just, you know, circumstances. You know, in Eight Men Out, which we're editing now, I play Ring Lardner, who was a famous writer at the time of the Black Sox scandal and was one of the people who covered the series and fairly early on knew about the fix. And he's not a bad guy.
No. How do you act and direct at the same time? I mean, for instance, if you're directing, you can actually watch the action and you'll have a sense about whether the scene worked or whether you need to do another take. You can't really be watching through peripheral vision while you're acting. That's certainly going to blow your scene.
On the last two movies, I worked with a guy named Steve Apicella who does video assist. And so you attach a video camera to your camera, or a video tap, actually. And so you can tape what you just shot. And so I rarely look at every take. But after I do a bunch, if I feel like I did a good job on one or two of the scenes, I'll go back and everything stops and you go and you look at the videotape. And before that, I just guessed. I just did it until I felt good about it and tried to make sure that any other actors in the scene who were behind me were ones who I felt good about.
Do you have to figure out how to assess your own performance, whether you're being like over-egotistical about your performance, if you think that you could have done better in that take, you know, asking everybody to do the scene over again?
Generally, I'll do a couple extra of my own just so that I know I've got it covered, you know. But usually I don't do any more takes than anybody else. I usually feel like I get it fairly quick. You know, I did write the lines, so it's not that difficult for me to learn them. You know, I kind of know the rhythm that I want. So, you know, there's one step that is eliminated, which is that I don't have to tell myself how to play the scene. I already have an idea of how to play the scene.
Right.
And I know how the director wants me to do it. And I know how it's
you're on
be,
good terms with him.
Yeah, and I know how it's going to be cut together. So in that way, you know, now and then I'll have a hard time with something because the blocking is difficult or whatever, and I'll have to do it a couple more times. But generally, I can hear it and feel it.
So has Mate One been a breakthrough film for you? It's still playing in a lot of theaters around the country. It got, I think, pretty good reviews and good word of mouth and everything. Has it changed your status in the film world?
No.
And what I mean by that is that you are always, you know, independent filmmaker, lower budget, and this was a big budget for you, modest by everybody else's standards.
Yeah, I don't think your status basically changes unless you have a runaway hit.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a runaway hit, even people who have no idea why it was a runaway hit want to go and kind of touch the magic for a while. And I've never had a runaway hit. I've had a lot of movies that were hits compared to their budgets, but if you only spend $400,000, you don't have to gross that much money to, like, double your profits and all that kind of thing. In fact, you know, I've had movies that were, you know, on our terms, financial successes, which grossed less money than an average, you know, Hollywood movie spends just on advertising. You know, so it's still, you know, kind of a like running a corner bodega compared to running the AMP chain. You know, Mate One's on a bigger scale, but it hasn't become a runaway hit. It's doing good, steady business in a lot of places. And one of the nice things is it's doing its best business in West Virginia, where people really are familiar with the history, and that makes us feel good because that's one of the things that we really cared about in making the movie. But I don't think it's changed my status.
Well, John Sayles, I want to thank you very much for talking about movies with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Sayles. He's a film director, also an actor. The films he's directed include Return of the Sokka 7, Liana, Baby It's You, Brother from Another Planet, his latest film, Mate One, and his forthcoming film, Eight Men Out. He's also written a new book titled Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. And I think I neglected to mention that he's a writer, too, and writes most of the screenplays that he directs. John Sayles joined us from the NPR Bureau in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll be joined by Jack Gillis, the Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America and author of The Car Book, A Guide to Buying 1988 Automobiles. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, the first modern jazz trombonist, J.J. Johnson, is back on the jazz scene after 17 years composing and arranging for movies and television. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from the World Saxophone Quartet, and television critic David Bianculli previews NBC's Jack Parr is Alive and Well, a retrospective of one of television's talk show pioneers. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. Confirmation hearings began today for Supreme Court nominee Anthony Kennedy, with little of the controversy that surrounded the administration's two previous choices. Senate Judiciary Committee member Strom Thurmond praised Kennedy as a model of judicial restraint.
Generally, the opinions written by Judge Kennedy take a law and order position. However, Judge Kennedy has made it clear that should law enforcement officers overstep legal bounds, he will not hesitate to limit overreaching. While the constitutional rights of criminal defendants must be protected, Judge Kennedy will not ignore the rights of victims or law-abiding citizens.
Kennedy is a U.S. Appeals Court judge in Sacramento, California. He's expected to face a week of tough questioning by the committee, but there's little doubt right now that he'll be confirmed. President Reagan's first choice was Robert Bork. His nomination touched off a bitter attack led by civil rights proponents, which defeated the nomination. Mr. Reagan's second choice, Douglas Ginsburg, withdrew after admitting he had occasionally smoked marijuana. On a vote of 4-4, the Supreme Court today struck down an Illinois law that required teenage girls to notify their parents about plans to have an abortion. The one-sentence opinion affirms a lower court order which struck down the law as unconstitutional. Today's tie vote means the question may come before the high court again. Joseph Scheidler is executive director of the Pro Action League, a group which opposes abortion.
We're disappointed, of course, whenever you give a young woman an opportunity to do something so destructive that can destroy not only her child but her own life. We think that that's a defeat for parents, a defeat for the youth, a defeat for the unborn. But we're just sorry it had to come before a court that was stalemated like this, and then it's not really a finding.
About half of the states require some parental involvement in a minor's decision to have an abortion. The first face-to-face meeting between Nicaragua's Sandinista government and the Contra rebels was postponed today at the request of the Sandinistas. The Nicaraguan government said the cancellation was for what they called technical reasons. President Reagan today promised to make no further reductions in nuclear weapons in Europe until the issue of Soviet conventional weaponry is addressed. In a speech before the Center of Strategic and International Studies, the president tried to reassure critics of the medium-range missile treaty that the U.S. is not abandoning its European allies.
We'll keep our American servicemen stationed in Western Europe. And let me ask, what more convincing form of coupling could there be than these hundreds of thousands of Americans and their dependents living and working among our European allies? Furthermore, let there be no doubt our commitment to the NATO strategy of flexible response will remain steadfast, assuring that aggression at any level cannot be successful.
The president also reaffirmed his support for the Strategic Defense Initiative, which he said will also press for a verifiable, rather he said he will also press for a verifiable agreement with the Soviets on reducing long-range missiles. The U.S. Postal Service is predicting a number of changes in its service if the Senate budget-cutting proposal becomes law. Deputy Postmaster Michael Coughlin.
We would probably have to reconsider the issue of closing some 10 to 12,000 post offices around the country. Most of them, of course, are in rural areas of the country. And I think we'd also have to look seriously, eventually, at the viability of our Saturday delivery service.
Postal officials say they may also be forced to seek another rate hike in 1990 of 3 or 4 cents. That would be in addition to the 3-cent increase planned for next April. Stock prices were sharply higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 65 points to close at 1932.85. Trading was active. 187 million shares changed hands. The average price gained 78 cents. I'm Michael Richards, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Dances and Ballads, the new album from the World Saxophone Quartet. The quartet's members are Hammett Bluyett, Julius Hempel, Oliver Lake, and David Murray. They came up through the ranks of the jazz avant-garde in the 70s and first joined forces as a quartet over a decade ago. Since then, they've recorded 8 albums, including a recent set of Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn compositions. Kevin says their new album may be their best.
Everyone agrees the World Saxophone Quartet is one of the key groups of the 80s. It wasn't the first such group. The sometimes jazzy New York Saxophone Quartet was founded in 1959, and the British trio SOS pointed the way in the early 70s. But since 1976, the WSQ, more than any other group, has helped popularize similar units like the Rova Saxophone Quartet and Clarinet Summit, and so-called single-instrument choirs like the percussion orchestra M-Boom. Live, the World Saxophone Quartet's appeal is obvious. The players are distinctive stylists. Julius Hempel and Oliver Lake play alto and soprano, David Murray plays tenor, and Hammett Bluyett is on baritone. Yet their blend is immaculate. Still, the presence the group has in concert, the ways they play with the acoustics of a hall, haven't always translated to record. And after a decade, the quartets sometimes find themselves in a rut. They've always played richly unfolding harmonies, voiced with the grace of a string quartet. And they've always hooted bedrock riffs like a swing band sax section and caterwauled in reed-talking ecstasy. Even so, they've had the potential for more. The WSQ's inspiration is part chamber group, part West African vocal and percussion choir. Either strain holds the promise of greater rhythmic sophistication, whether found in the irregular phrases modern academics write or in the polymetric sonic webs of ethnic drum ensembles. The quartet have hinted at such complexity before, but on their new album, Dances and Ballads, on Nonesuch, they manipulate time better than ever, as a new version of their theme, Hattie Wall, demonstrates. More than before, the players respond to the studio environment as they would to a concert hall. The heavy echo that can be so distracting on modern jazz records makes sense here. As in concert, the players leave space in the music to let notes resound and to let the rich overtones of four horns blend and clash. Juggling more lines at once, subdividing and recombining, they expand their range of colors as well. Listen to the last minute of Oliver Lake's Belly Up. Thank you.
Jazz fans rightly value longtime working groups, but we often forget that, like all major league teams, veteran units have slumps. Because Julius Hempel is so able a composer, his mates have let him do the brunt of the writing for the quartet. He'd begun to sound overworked. This time, writing chores are more evenly spread around, the music more various. The self-conscious balance between hyperactive dances and plush ballads is effective, too. Julius Hempel, Oliver Lake, David Murray, and Hammett Bluey had all come out of the jazz avant-garde and make liberal use of extended techniques, yet they play solos of great sensitivity and merge in whispering pastel chords. The World Saxophone Quartet reminds us that harsh sounds could be things of beauty, just like the pretty notes.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed Dances and Ballads, the World Saxophone Quartet's latest album on Nonesuch. This is Fresh Air. J.J. Johnson is considered the father of modern jazz trombone. He got his start touring with the big bands of Benny Carter and Count Basie, and then moved to New York, where he performed with musicians at the vanguard of the new music, bebop, like Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis. 17 years ago, Johnson virtually gave up his performance career to move to Los Angeles to compose and arrange music for movies and television. He worked on such programs as Starsky and Hutch, Mod Squad, That Girl, and movies including Cleopatra Jones and Across 110th Street. Now it's time for another change. J.J. Johnson is returning to his hometown, Indianapolis, and more important for jazz listeners, he's returning to the jazz scene. He's wrapping up a national concert tour. And RCA Bluebird has just reissued on compact disc his big band recordings from the 60s, including this 1964 performance of his composition El Camino Real. When I spoke to J.J. Johnson from Los Angeles, he told me why it was harder to keep up with the fast tempos of bebop on trombone than it was on trumpet and saxophone.
Visually, you can just picture it in your mind's eye, the fact that the saxophone player has these keys and buttons, as people call them, and a trumpet player has the same thing, but whereas the trombone has this ungainly, awkward-looking, long, tubular slide that he has to manipulate, it is awkward. And it's kind of a tricky situation to manipulate the trombone in such a manner as that you can conveniently and articulately play so-called bop and or the other modern forms of jazz.
You got your start playing in big bands. You played with Count Basie, with Benny Carter. How did you first hear modern jazz? How did you first hear bop?
My first, I guess you'd say the soloist that had the first impact on me that would be categorized as jazz or contemporary jazz improvisation would be Lester Young. In the old Count Basie days, some of the old great Count Basie records were classics that had Lester Young in full bore in his career. And from that, I would go to people like, of course, Dizzy and Bird came on the scene and changed everything around. They did, jazz did 180 degrees once Diz and Bird popped on the scene. So between Lester Young, Bud Powell, Diz and Bird, and people like that, those were my first impressions of so-called modern jazz, including bebop.
When you heard modern jazz and you knew you wanted to play it and you knew you'd have to find a way to play rapidly on the trombone, what did you isolate yourself for a while and just start practicing a lot to learn this new idiom?
You just said it, Terry. It was a question of practice, 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 research, research, research. I must say I got a lot of encouragement from people like, you would never believe it, Dizzy Gillespie. Dizzy plays trumpet, but you'd be surprised what Diz knows about trombone. And I recall vividly situations where Diz would sit down with me and just show me different ways of playing or executing a given passage on the trombone. And sure enough, it was better the way he would indicate and so forth. And just from practice and struggling and, you know, listening and practice, practice, practice.
You were back in the early 50s, one of the few people who could play modern jazz on trombone. Was there much of a call for it? Did many of the musicians show an interest in having a trombonist in the group?
There was some minimal interest. Yes, I can't say that there was a hue and cry, and you know, no one was tearing my door down for contemporary jazz trombone or bebop trombone, but. Little by little, you know, more and more guys started to get into the act. Let's say Kay Wending, Benny Green, a few guys started to dabble in that area of jazz. So that before you knew it, the trombones were holding their own with the saxophonists and with the trumpet players and whatnot.
How did you get to record with Charlie Parker?
Oh, it happened with different. Record producers such as Teddy Rigg and Al Lyons with the old Blue on the old Blue Note label, whatnot. Norman Granz was another guy who liked to just put together unusual and unlikely combinations of jazz players just to see what would happen. In fact, jazz at the Philharmonic got started that way. That was his kicks, just putting together groups of various guys and just, as he said that time, watch the sparks fly.
I think it was 1952 to 54, you basically left music for a while. What kind of job did you get during those years?
I don't recall specifically. It was a 9-to-5 job, and it was just a question of stepping outside the jazz arena, as it were, just to evaluate, take inventory, and I guess you might say that my life and my career in general has been kind of like that. I've on occasion stepped outside just to get a better view of what was going on with myself, what was going on with jazz, what was going on with modern jazz. So it was just a part of my way of evolving as a musician, as an artist.
When you returned to jazz in 1954, you organized the quintet with trombonist Kay Wending. How
right.
did you two get together?
That's an unusual story. You know, the original plan came from Teddy Rigg, who was a record producer, jazz record producer at that time. And his original plan was to form a team of two trombones between Benny Green and J.J. Johnson. Well, it so happened that Benny Green had what we would call a light regional hit going at that time. I don't recall what the song was or what the hit was, but he was making a little bit of noise and he was getting quite a bit of action, meaning he was quite busy. So to make a long story short, Teddy Rigg said, well, if we don't get Benny, we'll get Kay Wending and we'll put J.J. and Kay together. And there you have it. That's how J and K came about. Thank you.
end up leaving New York for Los Angeles to do music for movies and television?
Well, I had had this, I guess you might call it an urge, for some time, and the urge got stronger and stronger to get involved in film composition and film scoring. And I ran across a couple of old buddies, Quincy Jones and Lalo Schifrin, who were already into that area, and they gave me some encouragement about coming to Los Angeles and trying it out. And sure enough, in 1970, I moved to Los Angeles to have a go at it. And it worked out very well. I did some film scoring, some feature film scoring, and quite a bit of television episodic scoring and whatnot. Worked out very fine, as a matter of fact.
Well, you're making another big change in your life now. You're leaving Los Angeles. You're leaving the business of scoring for television and movies. And you're going to be returning to your hometown in Indianapolis. And you're touring now and performing again. What's the reason for this new shakeup in your life?
I lived in New York for a number of years, loved every minute of it, still have an ongoing love affair with New York City, but there came a time in my life, and my wife felt the same way, my wife Vivian, and I felt it was time to make a change, a dramatic change. And we've loved living in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has been good to us. And again, we have a love affair with Los Angeles, but again, it's time for a change, a dramatic change, and we're both from Indianapolis. The logical place to go is home.
Trombonist J.J. Johnson. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we're following the confirmation hearings of Judge Anthony Kennedy. This is the first day of Judge Kennedy's hearings. He, of course, is President Reagan's third nominee to fill that vacant seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Also, a report on a boom in the illegal drug trade out of Lebanon. Word that Boris Pasternak's novel, Dr. Zhivago, is to be published in Moscow in the magazine Ogonyuk. And some Christmas book gift hints from our reviewer, Alan Chu, also following a trumpeter, Stephen Burns, around New York as he prepared for his concert debut at Carnegie Hall.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review of a Jack Parr special that airs this weekend. It includes footage of some of the most famous and infamous moments during Parr's five-year reign as host of NBC's Tonight Show, when he interviewed everyone from John Kennedy and Richard Nixon to Zsa Zsa Gabor. The special also puts Parr back into active duty as a conversationalist.
Today I want to talk about the man who was the star of TV's first true talk show, Jack Parr. Now, I know there were other national and local talk shows before Parr took over The Tonight Show in 1957, and I'm certainly not forgetting about Steve Allen. But comparing Parr to Allen is like comparing Dick Cavett to David Letterman. Allen and Letterman are in search of laughs. Cavett and Parr wanted to have genuine conversations. That's why Parr became such a hit. He was unpredictable and emotional, but he was intelligent and witty, too, and those were equally strong assets. And in the 80s, where one in four Americans hosts a talk show, it's hard to recall a time during which TV talk wasn't cheap. But Parr gave viewers a chance to get close to celebrities and newsmakers and get to know them as people. It was rare then. And when you think about it, it's just as rare now. This Saturday night, NBC is presenting Jack Parr is Alive and Well, his second special in as many years. Debbie Reynolds and Jackie Mason guest star and come on to chat with Parr after watching clips of themselves performing on his show more than 20 years earlier. But the biggest bonus in the special comes at the beginning. For the first time in 27 years, Parr shows a recently discovered kinescope of the night he walked off his own program. The night before, NBC had censored a rather harmless joke of his. The offensive words were water closet. And Parr decided he was mad as hell and wasn't going to take it anymore.
I'm leaving The Tonight Show. There must be
a better way of making a living than this. You have been peachy to me always.
3 weeks later, Parr was back with a perfectly delivered comeback speech.
As I was saying before I was interrupted... I believe my last words were that there must be a better way of making a living than this. Well, I have looked. And there isn't.
Other vintage clips shown on this new special include a mid-60s routine by Mike Nichols and Elaine May that's almost long enough to be a one-act play, and a few tantalizing seconds from an interview with a very young man named Bobby Kennedy.
Is Hoffa an improvement over Dave Beck?
Oh, there's no comparison between Mr. Hoffa and Mr. Beck. Mr. Beck was just a thief. this is not...
We may be in court together, you and I.
I hope to hell you know what you're doing, because I don't play anything.
Nobody else is doing what Parr used to do. Not even Parr, whose conversations on this new special are, if you don't mind the pun, a bit below par. I think he may be underestimating himself and his audience by bringing on Debbie Reynolds and having her do impressions of Mae West and Jimmy Stewart. It would have been more interesting and more like Jack Parr to spend more time talking to Jackie Mason about the ups and downs of their respective careers. Jackie Mason, after all, did the same act for 3 decades and finally got discovered and appreciated by a whole new audience. Jack Parr is poised to do the same thing and still has the poise to carry it off.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with jazz critic Martin Williams. He compiled the new Smithsonian Jazz Collection box set featuring singers and soloists from the swing era. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will look back at the making of the Phil Spector Christmas album. And book critic John Leonard will review The Western Lands, the new novel by William Burroughs. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.